Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm great.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, was this the podcast election? As the home of several of the most listened to and most influential podcasts of the last election cycle, congratulations to Tim Miller for the flagship pod and The Next Level and Sarah Longwell's Focus Group podcast. Just great stuff that they're doing over there on the politics side of things. I like to think the answer is yes. Of course, obviously, this was the podcast election. Huge influence on the election. The entertainment strategy guy, not so sure. Not so sure. He crunched the numbers, wanted to dampen everyone's enthusiasm just a bit. First things first, he really, really needs people to understand that a view on YouTube does not mean somebody watched the whole thing. Right. Here is how he discusses Donald Trump's appearance on Joe Rogan's show, for instance. Quote, if those 46 million views translated into customers watching all 3 hours of Trump's Joe Rogan interview, that'd be 138 million hours, or the second most popular single show on streaming all year wide by a wide, wide margin. Spoiler, they don't actually
behind
translate.
Bridgerton.
But yeah, behind Bridgerton, yeah, second to Bridgerton. But they don't actually translate to that, right? I'm sure somebody somewhere knows what a view on YouTube is. There's some debate about it. It's a few seconds, maybe it's 30 seconds. But the point is simple, right? Watching a clip of something counts as a view, and most people watch clips rather than the whole thing. There are other things to consider, among them the spam/bot problem, right, on YouTube, and the fact that YouTube view totals are global, while Nielsen ratings just track U.S. audiences. So it's hard to say, like, oh, look at all these views on podcasts and the such compared to TV. It's not, you know, it's the podcast world. We're all just living in it. There's a potato-potato issue, I guess is what I'm saying, right? There's also a question of strategy, right? A lot of the questions about the election have come down to, did Kamala Harris do enough podcasts? You know, were they on the right shows? Was there a strong enough outreach effort made? You know, Trump and Vance were on all the podcasts. They were doing all the shows, and Harris wasn't. She was, whatever. It's more interesting to think about this way. I think. Who needs who more, right? So consider the question of Trump and Rogan again. Who needed whom more? I think most of us agreed that Trump going on Rogan was better for Trump than it was for Rogan. But the number of views for Rogan was an order of magnitude larger on the Trump episode than his average audience, right? Doesn't this suggest that Trump was actually more important to Rogan than vice versa? Regardless, the simple fact of the matter is that all these numbers, particularly when you break them down on a total hours viewed metric, right, which is kind of what the streamers like to use. They like, oh, they watch 47 million hours of this thing. The numbers in podcasting, YouTube, et cetera, they're just dwarfed by actual news programs, right? Like, here's the entertainment strategy guy. The nightly and cable news shows might get the same number of views, especially American views, as all of Trump's podcast appearances in a day or two. Right. So, I mean, I just think about that. There's so much TV content. There's so many people still watching it, even if, cable TV is kind of a market in decline, that it still enormously dwarfs what is actually being listened to in the world of podcasts. Now, this all has broader implications, right? And that's kind of why we're talking about it here today. This has broader implications than just podcasts and elections. It matters to the important things in the world, like the entertainment industry. We talk a lot on this show about YouTube and kind of, is it the future of entertainment? Is YouTube-style stuff the future of entertainment? But it does, Peter, seem that we kind of need to figure out the terms of how we discuss all of this stuff, what the audience actually is for these things. Because, again, we throw around views. We throw around, oh, there's millions of people watching this. And it's hard to say what it actually means.
Well, I agree with that. But that's often, and I don't want to say literally always, but that has historically often been true with media. So there's an old ad maker's adage that's where it's like, half my ads are working. I just don't know which half. You can go back to the newspaper business, which was tremendously influential, successful, and profitable before the internet kind of started to collapse it, right? I mean, the LA Times was in 1990, if I recall correctly, was the most profitable newspaper in the history of newspapers. It was just this massive money printing machine, and most local papers fell under that banner, but people didn't know. Editors did not know what it was that individual people were reading, right? So they would just thought this was a hot column. Oh, we sold a little bit more when we put this on A1 rather than something else. You could sort of, there were these like very rough metrics, but it was actually pretty difficult to figure out exactly what people were reading and for how long. And the idea that we have this, like, that we have this quite granular knowledge is really very new. In addition, it's true that nobody knows what a view is, but internally, anybody who's running a YouTube account actually has access to a huge amount of data. They know exactly when people are tuning in and tuning out. One of the really interesting things about the Mr. Beast production memo that leaked, I don't know, a month or two, with sometime earlier this year, was that they are obsessively tracking not just how many people click on the videos to start, but also all of the points where people log out. Like, where is the spot where people are like, I'm not watching this anymore? And where are the spots where what are the tricks that we can use to keep people engaged? And how can we iterate that and make sure that every video keeps people throughout the viewing period? In addition, I think even on TV news, there has sometimes been this problem. Again, these ads, you know, you don't know if people are getting up and going to the bathroom or getting a, you know, this is the time where they go get their popcorn or their soda in between segments. And so this idea that that all of this, you know, is like, it's weird that it's not trackable, I think is not quite right. A lot of this stuff has not been trackable historically. And so I think two things about this Entertainment Strategy Guy piece. One is, I'm obviously a huge fan of his work. And I think the data and the analysis that he is bringing to all of this is really valuable. And it really adds a lot of context to how we think about what podcasts are doing relative to other types of media. But I also think there's something that comes through less in that piece that is very important, which is that political influence is not always measured in popularity or engagement. And it has often been true that somewhat smaller, not tiny, tiny, but somewhat smaller, more niche, even fringe political publications, small magazines like the type that you and I worked at, Sunny, or like, I mean, you worked for Think Progress, Alyssa. It wasn't literally a magazine, but it was effectively a magazine. And the idea was that those relatively small operations could have outsized influence, not by being read extremely widely, although, yes, sometimes they were. Sometimes Reason is read extremely widely, right? Part of the game, part of the play there, the approach is to have influence by reaching the right people. And that then trickles down and out into the rest of the political discourse, even if you are not a mass popular success on the level of, say, Bridgerton.
Yeah, Alyssa, one thing that always jumps out at me when people talk about podcasts is the relationship folks have with podcasters, right? Like there's an intensity of relationship there that is different from... I like watching cable news, right? Like I enjoy watching CNN. I trust Jake Tapper. I like to listen, but it's not the same sort of relationship, I think, that the average, you know, the average CNN watcher, the average CNN viewer does not have the same relationship to the anchors, to the channel itself, that people do with somebody like a Joe Rogan or a Theo Von or whatever, right? Like these or a Tim Miller, right? Like these are or an Alyssa Rosenberg, frankly. It's a different type of relationship. And so even if it is smaller, it is still pretty important, I think.
Yeah, but don't you think that there are a lot of different kinds of relationships like that? And it's not always in media, right? I mean, that kind of intensity might exist between a churchgoer and their pastor, or someone who's sort of active in a local party or a nonprofit organization. I think, in fact, you know, Trump, in an interesting way, has managed to cultivate that kind of intense personal relationship on a mass scale. And so I don't know that this is the podcast election in the sense that podcasters swung the election, but in, you know, in the sense that one of the candidates kind of behaves like a podcaster, and that he, you know, you can think of his rallies as live shows. There is this intense sort of parasocial relationship between, you know, Trump and his, you know, his listeners, his rally attendees. There is merch.
It's extemporaneous bullshit, but, you know, that like builds the character.
Right, exactly. And it's like, you know, there's a huge volume of this stuff. There's a tendency to sort of just like go on and on and on. It's like, and Trump very much understands that that's what he is doing, right? I mean, he talks about like people want a show, right? And so, you know, I think that it's not so much that podcasting has superseded other forms of media. It's that sort of the style and rhythms of podcasting have become politics.
Yeah, I think that's really right. And that is a something that Kamala Harris in particular did not master.
Yes. Yeah. And it didn't, you know, she was, in fact, incredibly bad at it. Right. I mean, she was so incredibly unextemporaneous, right? You know, it's not just that she was not a strong performer in sort of an adversarial interview context, but she was not someone who's just going to stand up and like talk for 2 hours off the cuff, you know?
To make an analogy here, then, she's basically Nixon in the Nixon-JFK race.
Yeah.
Unable to master a new communication medium, TV, in a way that makes her appealing to the mass audience.
Yeah, I think that's a great extension of what I'm saying, and I think that's totally correct.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's interesting because again, I am skeptical of the idea that podcasts in particular are the tipping point, you know, whatever. I think the entertainment strategy guy is right to kind of throw a little bit of cold water on this, in part because of the point he makes in his piece. I'll link to it in my newsletter, though I think you have to be a subscriber to read the whole thing. One of the points he makes in his argument is that if you saying something like this was the podcast election and it not actually being the podcast election leads to all sorts of bad consequences when folks, pour millions and millions of dollars into creating, you know, podcast networks, that sort of thing, when that is not necessarily a good expenditure of money. So I think it's important to keep all this in mind. At the same time, it is very obviously a key communication format that modern, especially younger voters tend to key in on. And politicians just have to be able to do this sort of thing now.
Yes.
Like it's a new thing they have to be able to do.
Yeah. I mean, the combination of being spontaneous, extemporaneous, but also, you know, controlled. I think those things are in tension to a certain extent. And that's probably why it's a hard skill to master. I mean, the fact that Trump is, you know, spontaneous, extemporaneous, but totally uncontrolled makes it much easier for him to do this.
But then you see someone like J.D. Vance, who, whatever else you think of him, is good at the format. That's not an argument for J.D. Vance. I'm not saying J.D. Vance is great. I have a lot of issues with J.D. Vance. At the same time, like, watch him on one of these shows where he just has to speak at length for a long time. He was the youngest person on either ticket, and he came up in this environment, basically, I mean, sort of, before he was a senator, he was basically just a blogger. I mean, yes, he also did investments and it was in the military and a bunch of other stuff, but like he came up in politics. His entry into politics was by writing online and then eventually by like talking on podcasts in the way that frankly a lot of people who like we know this, it's sort of like he really sort of felt like someone who could be kind of part of the, you know, the blogger podcaster social circle in DC. He's actually about our age, and he was just, it was just natural for him because he's of that age. And I think this will actually be something where it won't be that you're not going to find a lot of younger politicians who like really are very bad at this. Yeah, probably some, but in the same way that everyone in media who is under 50 or so is just used to this being part of the job. And sure, some people are better at it than others. Some people have a real natural gift for holding other people's attention on microphone or on camera, in particular, like on a on a, you know, a cell phone camera, right? Like, some people can do that better than others, for sure. But for people who are younger and who are coming up through politics, it's not just that they're going to have to be good at it. It's that this is going to be the filtering system and the gauntlet that they have to run in order to get into politics. And it's going to filter out people who are bad at it.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that people are kind of describing this as the podcast election? Peter?
I don't think it's a controversy. I think the fact that we are talking about it and that Entertainment Strategy Guy is having to refute it with like reasonable data and real numbers and like actual analysis suggests that it's going to end up being the podcast election, even if podcast listenership is not as big as some people might think.
Alyssa?
I think it's a controversy, but I do think it's an interesting shift in both media and the sort of what I think will end up being sort of the dominant style of politics. And I think that epical shift is really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a controversy, but it is, as Peter and Alyssa both say, like this, there is a shift happening and trying to figure out the magnitude of it and also how to best utilize it is going to be a key part of any campaign strategy going forward. And if it's not, you got to get a new campaign strategist, frankly.
Yeah, more presidential candidates need to come on across the movie aisle and tell us their top 10 favorite movies of the year.
Honestly, the fact if you want to be president of this country, you got to bend the knee to across the movie aisle, is my understanding.
Going to be a lot of Zack Snyder fans trying to get into the Oval Office.
All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on the most anticipated films of 2025. 2025, right around the corner. We got some things we're looking forward to. And now on to the main event. A movie that I don't think was the highlight of 2024. That's for sure. Kraven the Hunter, the latest and apparently final entry in Sony's expanded Spider-Man universe of movies that oddly never once featured Spider-Man in any role, not even as a cameo, I don't think.
Wait, so it's the SUMC. I thought it stood for Sony Universe of Marvel Characters.
It's the Sony Pictures Universe of Marvel Characters, also known as the Spider-Man something universe. I don't know. There are two different acronyms, which shows you how much effort and thought went into crafting this whole thing. Anyway, we'll get to that in a second. We'll get to that in 1 second. The first and most basic question we have to ask here is simply, is Kraven the Hunter a good movie? And the answer to that is no. The answer to that is no, not really. It's a soggy mishmash of underbaked subplots and an admittedly amusingly hammy performance by Russell Crowe, but also a completely empty lead performance from Aaron Taylor-Johnson with a little dash of style from J.C. Shandor, like shots of guys kind of silhouetted against windows. Looks kind of cool, but it just gets overwhelmed by the CGI slop throughout. There's so much CGI slop in this movie. Spoilers are coming, I guess, but you're honestly better off just letting us spoil the movie for you. So, I don't know. You can stop listening if you want, but you're not going to be missing a whole lot. Anyway, so the movie kicks off with an action beat in which we see Kraven take out a Russian mob boss in a Siberian prison using his super animal powers. That's what he's got. He's super animal. He's got animal superpowers. And then we get a flashback, an extended flashback, to see how Kraven got those powers. Long story short, he hates his dad. He's got daddy issues. His dad, of course, is the Russian gangster played by Russell Crowe. And he's very protective of his half-brother, who is played as a grown man by Fred Hechinger. When Kraven almost dies on the hunt, a huge lion almost kills him. But he's saved by a mysterious young woman named Calypso, who will be played as an adult by Ariana DeBose later on in the film. She uses a family potion to bring him back to life. Yada, yada, yada. Kraven now has the power of lions, I guess. More or less. Also, maybe birds.
He's good at climbing things. I don't think lions are that good at climbing things.
He's very good. He's got lots of hand strength, hand and feet strength.
How many lions have you guys met? I don't know. Maybe lions are awesome at climbing.
I think lions are pretty good climbers. You know,
people have
cats.
to run very high up a tree to climb to hide from a lion.
Anyway, A gangster who turns into a rhino, who's played by Alessandro Nivola, wants to take over Russian Russell Crowe's territory. And to do this, he'll have to stop Craven. So he hires a mysterious assassin whose powers I literally could not explain to you if you gave me a $100 bill. If you were like, here's $100, explain to me what Christopher Abbott's powers are in this movie. Wouldn't be able to do it. No idea. He says 1, 2, 3 and people, he disappears in front of them. I don't know. Doesn't make any sense. That's literally what happens, by the way. He says 1, 2, 3 and then he disappears. Doesn't matter. The film culminates in a fight between Craven and Rhino in the midst of a rampaging herd of CGI wildebeest, and it looks about as dumb as that sounds. I was disappointed by everything in this movie. Now, look, here's the thing. I like nearly every actor in this movie, right? Aaron Taylor Johnson is usually better than he is here. I thought he was just awful in this movie. At one point in my notebook, I wrote down, does he know how to walk like a normal person? Because he's like constantly, his arms are like kind of hanging out by his side. I was like, are you having one of those episodes where you like get high and you're like, how do my arms work? What do I do?
It's called Charlie Hunnam syndrome.
That is kind of what Charlie Hunnam is like, actually. That's not a bad comparison. Anyway, I like him usually. He's not good here. And the other actors are pretty good. I thought Nivola does a good job with a kind of terribly underwritten role. Hechinger is good, even though they waste the chameleon. Like, I have so many, most of my angry thoughts about this movie have to do with them wasting the chameleon, who's one of the great Spider-Man villains in a nothing throwaway movie that's crashing and burning. Abbott's good. I like Christopher Abbott a lot. I like it when he shows up in things. He's good in this, even though his character is incredibly dumb. DeBose, she's pretty good. Again, I like Russell Crowe. He's very hammy. I like that. I don't know. They're doing the best they can with miserable, miserable material. Just confused and unclear and pointless. And really, that's why Kraven the Hunter is kind of a perfect metaphor for this whole expanded spunk SSU thing that Sony has been trying to pull off. Full disclosure here, I'm a nerd. Like, I don't say that with pride. Like, people are like, oh, well, I'm reclaiming nerd. No, it's shameful. I'm ashamed of what I am. And I'm very specifically a Spider-Man nerd, right? I read like a million Spider-Man comics growing up. And Kraven's always been kind of a goofy villain, but he at least makes sense as a Spider-Man villain because he's like the world's greatest big game hunter and Spider-Man is the biggest game of all, right? Like, Kraven literally only makes sense as a compelling character in the context of Spider-Man, just as Madame Web only makes sense as a character in the context of Spider-Man, and Morbius only really makes sense as a character in the context of Spider-Man, and Venom especially only makes sense in the context of Spider-Man. I mean, Venom is literally a spinoff of a former costume of Spider-Man. Spider-Man isn't in any of these movies. Zero movies starring Spider-Man in the Spider-Man extended universe. I don't understand what they're doing. Making a Kraven movie where Kraven is hunting poachers, he hates poachers, is like making a Shaft movie where Shaft is a drug lord. It's like the opposite of the character. It doesn't make any sense. And then you make a Kraven movie where he's not hunting Spider-Man. Why? Why? What's the point? What's the point of any of this? It doesn't even make money. That's the worst part. It'd be one thing if these were hugely successful, and I guess the Venom movies have done fine, but it's baffling. I am baffled by this series. I am baffled by all of the creative choices that led to this moment in my life. I'm questioning a lot of things about myself, about the universe, about the industry writ large. Alyssa, are you sad that we won't have the spunk SSU to kick around anymore?
No, I don't care about any of these movies. And I'm actually, I'm especially bummed by this one because it nods at a sort of a world historical development that could make for a really good J.C. Chandor movie, like specifically a very good J.C. Chandor movie. And that is the extent to which London has become kind of a parking ground for, like a parking lot for shady money. This has been going on for a while. The sort of phenomenon of like Russian oligarchs buying up kind of fancy real estate and, parking money in London, has been going on for quite a while. Patrick Radden Keefe actually had a really amazing and sad story in The New Yorker earlier this year about a family whose kid was pretending to be like an oligarch's kid, got mixed up with a bunch of sort of screwy people and died a couple years ago. And that's like exactly the makeup of a great J.C. Chandor movie, right? Like money, a city, you know, sort of things that are not as they seem. It's like, I mean, the guy who made A Most Violent Year, who made Margin Call, you know, just that's sort of a subject that's tailor-made for him. And so you have this interesting tension in the movie where, you know, Russell Crowe's character is, you know, this just like this totally corrupt criminal person who has purchased a bunch of the trappings of sort of British gentility. And the movie is just, and, you know, then also sort of gestures at like, you know, Ariana DeBose's Calypso is a lawyer who's like ostensibly fighting corruption somehow or other. But the movie never does anything with that sort of tension between surface and underworld, between the idea that sort of the, you know, the atmosphere of gentility can get bought up until it's no longer meaningful. And the movie just, it's a very strange movie. It feels edited really oddly. I mean, the dialogue is terrible. Like, there's literally a scene where, you know, Ariana DeBose's character, who, like, it's just sort of plucked down in the movie because, like, Craven needs to get some weird serum at some point. She literally, she's like, I don't think do things like that. I'm a lawyer. And it's like,
there's so much ADR in this movie. So there's so much like dialogue that was very clearly recorded after the fact, because like you'll hear people talking and the camera will just be on somebody who's reacting to them. It was like clearly added in post.
Or frankly, CGI lips. And it's amazingly not as bad as Madame Web, which had a villain character where literally not one line of dialogue appeared to be the thing that he was actually saying when they shot the scene on the set. And this movie actually has some scenes that appear to have been like rendered something like the way they were shot. But far too many of the scenes in this movie were clearly, they were rewritten after the fact. And that's part of what gives it the odd editing effect that you're talking about, Alyssa. I'm sure there was also a lot of like rejiggering of the story in the editing room as well. But a huge amount of what feels so weird about this movie is the actors are not saying the lines that they were saying when they were filmed saying lines.
At least the action was good, right, Alyssa? Coherent?
No.
Pretty to look at?
No.
No. Peter, what'd you make of Kraven the Hunter?
This is an absolute garbage movie. And what's amazing is it's not even the worst of the sunk movie universe films. That definitely goes to Madame Web, which, as a friend of mine said, is a movie that's so bad that if you tried to make a movie this bad, you would fail. It would be better than that. And this is the kind of movie that you would end up making if you tried to make a movie as bad as Madame Web. It's just sort of relentlessly crappy and mediocre at every moment. And you can almost in this one, unlike I think Morbius and Madame Web, you can almost see that there's a hint of someone trying to make a good movie at some point in the process. Like, this movie probably took 2 or 3 years to get to theaters. I mean, actually, it was hugely delayed, so maybe more like 4 years, including development time, etc.
Well, it was on the shelf for like 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. So there's hugely, but like this movie probably took a couple of years of like the top creator, the above the line talents, like you know, the filmmakers' lives. And at some point, J.C. Chandor was like, "I want to make a good movie." It didn't happen, but you can kind of see like just that little spark of it. And that's part of what makes this so frustrating is that J.C. Chandor has not made a crappy movie before. He's made some movies that I think people don't super love, like every one of them, right? Like there's, or that you could kind of argue with, but he's not made movies that are just like relentlessly awful like this. And so this movie, I think, actually more than any other superhero movie we have ever watched, really goes to the heart of the Alyssa Rosenberg critique of the superhero movie boom, which is that it is taking good directors or promising directors, especially those early in their careers, and taking them out of making good movies for at least a couple of years of their life to make this something that's just misconceived at every level. Unpleasant to watch. The only thing that works about this is Russell Crowe's performance, and that doesn't even come close to saving it. And it only works in the way that in something like the way that some of the Eddie Brock what's his name, who plays Venom in the Venom movies?
Tom Hardy?
The Tom Hardy role. That's like Tom Hardy gives a ridiculous but kind of enjoyably hammy performance in the Venom movies. And there's a way, there is a similar way that Russell Crowe is ridiculous but kind of enjoyably hammy in this film. But everything else about it is just listless and crappy and wasteful of the talent that you have on screen.
Yeah, I mean, it literally just feels like it was sort of edited together at random. It's very odd.
Yeah, and I think a movie like this, it's not, this on its own is not going to be the death knell for superhero movies. We've got more Marvel movies coming next year. But one thing that you, the lesson that needs to be learned, and that I frankly think will be learned from this attempt to build a secondary, sort of, kind of, but not really related to the Marvel Universe franchise with the properties that Sony owns from their Spider-Man deal. I think the lesson that needs to be learned and that will be learned is that you can't just make a movie out of any superhero IP. Like, you actually have to develop these things and make real movies and real stories and real characters. People won't show up, and if the movie is truly terrible, like, this is not going to work, because these films have gotten, it's not just progressively worse, but also they've done progressively worse at the box office. I think it's pretty clear why this strategy was hatched, and that's that the first Venom made something like $800 million globally. And then right after that, Joker, a solo DC Comics supervillain film that did not feature Batman, made $1 billion globally. And so you look at those two films and you own all of these villain characters, if you're Sony, and you say, okay, we're going to just develop all of those. But they did the absolute worst possible job of developing them, and they never provided, and it's not just that they were bad movies, it's that they were movies that didn't appeal to the core, totally discarded with the core appeal of these characters. This is what you were going for, Sonny, or part of what you were talking about, is that all of these characters, the appeal of them, it's not just that they are good Spider-Man villains, is that they reveal a different part of Spider-Man. When Kraven comes after Spider-Man, it is revealing the kind of animalistic nature of Spider-Man and also the ways in which Spider-Man is averse to the sort of hunter-like, murdery stuff that Kraven is like lives for and has as his creed. When Venom goes after Spider-Man, Venom thinks he's the hero. It's just that he's crazy and psychotic, and that also brings out the kind of the decency and the gentleness, frankly, of Spider-Man's character. And you can't bring out, you can't, if you don't have the foil of Spider-Man, and frankly, these characters are the foils to Spider-Man. If you don't have that yin and yang, you complete me kind of relationship there, then these characters don't have any reason to exist. And so this is not my point. But there was a critic who wrote something to the effect of part of what they've done in discarding Spider-Man is to say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to make all of these villains much more like Spider-Man. And so here you even see that Kraven moves like Spider-Man, that he's like jumping around, sticking to walls and stuff. It's like, well, we don't have any idea what this character exists to do apart from Spider-Man. So he's just going to be Spider-Man. It's an absolutely terrible way to develop a property, and good riddance to what is certainly the worst superhero franchise of the modern era, like since 1999 or so, and what might be the worst big budget studio franchise of my lifetime, or at least the worst one that has four movies or more.
Well, these movies all harken back to a earlier worst time of this sort of thing, right? Like the movies that these call to mind are stuff like the Halle Berry Catwoman, or the Jennifer Garner Elektra movie, or like, there's so many bad comic book movies that have been made. Basically all the Punisher movies. I don't know.
I have a soft spot for some of the Punisher films, but they're not good, but
I mean, whatever. I like the Thomas Jane one fine, but that's, you know, there's neither here nor there. It wasn't a particularly good movie. It certainly wasn't a successful movie. And that's, you know, again, it's one thing. These are all so cynical. Like, that's really the issue here, is that they're all just cynical cash grabs, but they don't even, most of them don't even make money. And that's what is, like, weirdly infuriating about them. I don't mind a bad movie that has a reason to exist, as long as that reason is, like, studio needs money, fine. But, like, these are not just bad, but they're also failures.
Yeah, the thing that you learn from this, from watching this movie, from watching Madame Web earlier this year, Morbius, what, a year or two ago, whatever that came out, the thing that you learn is that you can't actually just make any old movie based on a comic book superhero or supervillain character and expect that fans will show up and that you've got an $800 million or a billion-dollar property. And I think people, you know, coming out of like Guardians of the Galaxy being a huge success, in part because it was a very, like, a quite good movie, still
really
one of the better
good
Marvel films. Coming out of Guardians of the Galaxy, which no one had heard of, but like they were like, wow, you really can just take anything and like you spend $150 million, give it to a weirdo director, and $1 billion, right? It's magic. It's just like it's a $1 billion check you write to yourself. It doesn't actually work that way.
No. No, it doesn't. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Kraven the Hunter? Peter.
I could not give this movie more thumbs down.
Alyssa.
I feel like I can't even muster enough passion about this movie to have an opinion about it, which I like, thumbs down, obviously.
Thumbs up. Great movie. Everyone should watch it. All right. That is it for this week's show. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. No, you're not going to find too many podcasts that recommend Kraven the Hunter like I just did. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.